From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A pipeline has exploded in rural Milford, Texas, and police have reportedly asked residents of nearby areas to evacuate. There were no injuries reported. Milford is a small town along Interstate 35E, northeast of Hillsboro in southern Ellis County. It has a population of about 700 people, according to its website, and is about 50 miles south of Dallas. County officials said a 10-inch pipeline east of U.S. Highway 77 was being worked on when it exploded. The location is in an open field with no nearby structures threatened. Reports said there were several vehicles parked near the pipeline that were destroyed by the explosion and fire. Students in the Milford Independent School District were taken to a neighboring town where they waited for parents to pick them up. A local TV news report said a wider area may have to be evacuated because another pipeline could be at risk. The UN's top humanitarian official called for a sustained and collective response from the international community to help those affected by the typhoon that has devastated the Philippines. We have this report from UN Radio.
UN Humanitarian Coordinator Valerie Amos is appealing for a sustained and collective international response to help people affected by the deadly typhoon which hit the Philippines nearly a week ago. Amos was in the Philippine capital, Manila, on Thursday, where she highlighted the need for continued support to survivors of Typhoon Haiyan. Although UN agencies and their partners have reported logistical challenges in delivering aid, she said life-saving supplies have arrived in the city of Tacloban, one of the worst affected by the storm. The humanitarian chief visited the city on Wednesday, where she saw tens of thousands of people who are living in the open or sheltering in the remains of their homes or badly damaged public buildings. Speaking of that visit, Ms. Amos said, "People with absolutely nothing are doing their best to regain some degree of normality. We must do all we can to ensure they receive the help they desperately need." Deanne Penn, United Nations.
The typhoon slammed the country over the weekend, and according to the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or OCHA, some 11 million people have been affected, with more than 660,000 displaced. The delivery of aid has been hampered by a series of logistical challenges. Most airports have now reopened, although electric power has not been restored in many areas. Roads are still covered with debris, and there are fuel shortages reported. However, as time passes, more aid is reaching more people. On Tuesday, the UN Relief Agency launched an appeal for a $301 million flash fund to provide humanitarian assistance. UN agencies are stepping up efforts to provide health and medical supplies as well as food. Yesterday, the World Food Program airlifted life-saving supplies, including 2,500 metric tons of high-energy biscuits, to Tacloban. In addition, the UN International Telecommunications Union deployed dozens of satellite phones equipped with GPS to facilitate search and rescue efforts, along with other equipment to help families reestablish contact. President Barack Obama met Republican critics of his health care reform act today head-on. In a press conference at the White House, he spoke about the relative importance of the errors and missteps that have occurred against the need to provide health care for the millions who have previously gone without.
Over time, I think you're going to find that the marketplaces are better. One way I describe this, and it's not a perfect analogy, but we made a decision as a society that every car has to have a seatbelt or airbags. And so you pass a regulation. And there's some additional cost, particularly at the start, of increasing the safety and protections, but we make a decision as a society that the costs are outweighed by the benefits of all the lives that are saved. So what we're saying now is, if you're buying a new car, you gotta have the seatbelt. Well, the problem with the grandfather clause that we put in place is, it's almost like we said to folks, you gotta buy a new car. even if you can't afford it right now. And sooner or later, folks are going to start trading in their old cars. But, you know, we don't need, if their life circumstance is such where, for now at least, they want to keep the old car, even if the new car is better, we should be able to give them that option. And that's what we want to do. And by the way, that's what we should have been able to do in drafting the rules in the first place. So, again, you know, these are two fumbles on something that, on a big game, which, but the game's not over. With respect to the politics of it, you know, I'll let you guys do a lot of the work on projecting what this means for various political scenarios. There is no doubt that our failure to roll out the ACA smoothly has put a burden on Democrats, whether they're running or not, because they stood up and supported this effort through thick and thin. And, you know, I feel deeply responsible for making it harder for them rather than easier for them to continue to promote the core values that I think led them to support this thing in the first place, which is, in this country, as wealthy as we are, everybody should be able to have the security of affordable health care. That's why I feel so strongly about fixing it. My first and foremost obligation is the American people to make sure that they can get what's there if we can just get the darn website working and smooth this thing out, which is plans that are affordable and allow them to take advantage of tax credits and give them a better deal. But I also do feel an obligation to everybody who out there who supported this effort. You know, when we don't do a good job on the rollout, we're letting them down. And, you know, I don't like doing that. So my commitment to them is we're going to just keep on doing better every day until we get it done. And in terms of the impact on me, I think to some extent I addressed it when I talked to Julie. You know, there are going to be ups and downs during the course of my presidency. And, yeah, I think I said early on when I was running, I am not a perfect man and I will not be a perfect president. But I'll wake up every single day working as hard as I can on behalf of Americans out there from every walk of life who are working hard, meeting their responsibilities, but sometimes are struggling because the way the system works isn't giving them a fair shot. And that pledge I haven't broken. That commitment, that promise continues to be continues to hold. The promise that I wouldn't be perfect, number one, but also the promise that as long as I've got the honor of having this office, I'm just going to work as hard as I can to make things better for folks. And what that means specifically in this healthcare arena is we can't go back to the status quo. I mean, right now, everybody is properly focused on us not doing a good job on the rollout. And that's legitimate, and I get it. There have been times where I thought we were kind of, you know, slapped around a little bit unjustly. This one's deserved, right? It's on us. But we can't lose sight of the fact that the status quo before the Affordable Care Act was not working at all. If the healthcare system had been working fine and everybody had high quality health insurance at affordable prices, I wouldn't have made it a priority. We wouldn't have been fighting this hard to get it done, which is why when I see sometimes folks up on Capitol Hill and Republicans in particular who have been suggesting, you know, repeal, let's get rid of this thing, I keep on asking, what is it that you want to do? Are you suggesting that the status quo was working? Because it wasn't. And everybody knows it. It wasn't working in the individual market, and it certainly wasn't working for the 41 million people who didn't have health insurance. And so what we did was we chose a path that was the least disruptive to try to finally make sure that healthcare is treated in this country like it is in every other advanced country, that it's not some privilege that just a certain portion of people can have, but it's something that everybody has some confidence about. And you know, we didn't go far left and choose an approach that would have been much more disruptive. We didn't adopt some more conservative proposals that would have been much more disruptive. We tried to choose a way that built off the existing system. But it is complicated, it is hard, but I make no apologies for us taking this on, because somebody sooner or later had to do it. I do make apologies for not having executed better over the last several months.
But what did Americans give up for Obamacare? Black Agenda Report's Bruce Dixon recently wrote that there's a term in economics called an opportunity cost. He said the opportunity cost of a project is the negative value of the thing you give up in order to get the thing you got. In the case of so-called Obamacare, he says what was given up was a single-payer health care system, the option avoided at every opportunity by the president and Democrats in Congress, despite majority support among their constituents for single-payer. Dixon asks, what did we gain, what did we lose, and was it worth it? He said, you decide. More than 3,200 people in federal and state prisons in the United States are serving life without parole for nonviolent crimes, according to a study released yesterday by the ACLU. The report, titled A Living Death, relays the stories of thousands of people impacted by the late 20th century obsession with mass incarceration and extreme inhumane penalties, which leaves those affected likely to die behind bars, even though they are not serious or violent offenders. From crimes ranging from possession of a bottle cap smeared with heroin residue to working as a middleman in a $10 drug sale, the ACLU says that punishment thought to be reserved for the most violent in the U.S. is also being meted out to others, often for minor crimes. Of the 3,278 people across the country serving life sentences without parole, the vast majority surveyed by the ACLU, 83.4%, received the punishment as a consequence of mandatory sentencing laws. One example, on January 2, 1996, Timothy Jackson took a jacket from a department store in New Orleans, draped it over his arm, and walked out without paying for it. When he was stopped by a security guard, he said, "I just needed another jacket." A few months later, he was convicted of shoplifting and sent to the notorious Angola prison in Louisiana. That was 16 years ago. Today, he's still incarcerated in Angola and will stay there for the rest of his natural life, condemned to die in jail for the theft of a jacket worth $159. Jackson, now 53, is only one of those thousands serving life sentences with no chance of parole for nonviolent crimes. Some, like him, were given life sentences for shoplifting, one for siphoning gasoline from a truck, another for stealing tools from a tool shed, and another for attempting to cash a stolen check. All in all, the report reveals that the U.S. sentences four times as many people to life without parole as it did 20 years ago. Federal courts account for 63% of the 3,278 life without parole sentences for nonviolent offenses. The remaining prisoners are in Louisiana, which has 429, Florida, which has 270, Alabama, which has 244, Mississippi, which has 93, South Carolina, which has 88, Oklahoma, which has 49, Georgia, which has 20, Illinois, which has 10, and Missouri, which has 1. The ACLU estimates that federal and state taxpayers spend nearly $2 billion keeping these people in prison for life. The report calls on state and federal sentencing laws that mandate or allow life without parole for nonviolent crimes to be abolished. It also called on state governors and President Obama to commute the sentences of those currently serving. In the two decades since the Guillermo Morales Asada Shakur Community and Student Center at City College in New York was opened, it has served as both a community hub and focal point for political organizing activity in New York City. It's also been a target of certain forces inside the city government and the CUNY system. Last month, those forces preemptively shut the center down without prior notice. As those who use and value the center have organized their response, the city and its agents at CUNY have suspended, arrested, pepper-sprayed, and otherwise brutalized students and alumni for exercising their free speech rights. Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg are the hosts of Building Bridges, a weekly radio program based in New York. They spoke with two of the suspended students about the closure, their own status, and the struggle to reopen this valuable community resource.
It's been 3 weeks since public safety raided and closed the Guillermo Morales and Asada Shakur Community and Student Center at City College, which had provided books and fresh food at low prices to students and community members in Harlem. And it was a center for political activity for two decades now. In response, students have protested, and then came the arrests. Alumni were pepper sprayed, and student leaders were suspended. On top of what the students are terming the militarization of the campus, CUNY has proposed a draft policy on expressive activity. It proposes severe limitations on how the fundamental and distinct freedoms of speech and assembly may be exercised at the City University.
The policy is an attempt to silence dissent and to stifle protest before it starts. The recent behavior of CCNY, followed by the policy of expressive activity, flies in the face of the founding of CUNY itself. CUNY was founded in 1847 as a result of a disruption and dissent, and several of its colleges have been saved from closing during fiscal crisis because of protest and assembly. The closing of the Morales Chakra Center and the proposed chilling restrictions on expressive activity are anathema to the very character and purpose of an educational institution. We're now joined by Khalil Vasquez and Tafadar Sarov, suspended student activists.
And good evening to both of you. And my goodness, you really should be sitting right by us at this moment. But you are not only suspended, you're prevented from going onto the grounds of this campus. And I'm mad as hell, and I hope we don't take it anymore. But let's leave the story to both of you. Why don't we begin by talking a little bit more about the significance, the importance, the expression that emanated from the Morales Shakur Center, because I sure as hell want to maintain that name, and I'm not going to allow I'm not going to use the name that the institution now wants to give to it. Khalil, why don't we start with you?
Good evening. I would like to say, I mean, it's unfortunate, but it's not unexpected that CUNY administration is willing to effectively, right? There's been this historic process of privatizing the campus, but now we even see in the final and in its full closing to the community, they need to fully militarize. And we see this with the locking down of the building that happened since they seized the center, which is October 20th. I would say October 20th. That was the first time they locked down the building. We discovered when the center was closed. Since then, we were doing, you know, actions, peaceful but militant actions against the administration and the seizing of the center and the lockdowns of the NACS building effectively. And we were met with repression overtly, right? Not just from not just on the ground from security, but they even had to suspend myself and my comrades.
Before we get to the suspensions, but why? What do you think? I mean, we've said for two decades now we've had the Guillermo Morales, the Asada Shakur Center. Yes, it's named after, by the students, named after two revolutionaries who are now in Cuba, fleeing from the unjust wrath of the policing institution that is the United States at this point. So what did the center do? Why would they vamp on the center at this point?
So what the center is, it's like a representation of a different type of CUNY, the one that we're actually like struggling to create. So Kalula and I are both a part of the Revolutionary Student Coordinating Committee, and the analysis of our organization is that like the entire structure of like society in New York City is like set to oppress against, is set to like discriminate against oppressed nationality people or people of color and working class people. That's present in like the secondary educational system, where the high schools are underfunded in working class neighborhoods and like majority people of color neighborhoods. So that kids are either pushed out into the streets and into the prisons, or into like, you know, some of them, 13% of them graduate college ready, and like out of there people go to college. So like 87% of like the New York City public education system isn't prepared correctly. So when they get to college, most people who live in New York City, which are like black and brown working class people, are like either funneled into the community colleges or, you know, don't finish college. And the amount of like black and Latino enrollment in like the senior colleges is decreasing at the same time. So like this is how it's changing economically as CUNY is being gentrified. And we think that like as this is happening and like the state is like going through like so many pains to facilitate this process, it's like a byproduct of the overall like changes towards neoliberalism in our world system. So we think this is very much related to like racism, capitalism, and that's why we believe that it's no surprise that as they lock down these buildings and bring out police to beat us, you know, they're also stopping and frisking people in the community, in the Harlem community around. We think that like these things are connected, and that the reason they took the Morales Shakur Center right now is because of like the level of development and escalation of militarization of CUNY as it's transforming into a gentrified institution that's being taken away from the community.
So Khalil, in terms of the increased, and now after this they suspend you and Trovador, tell us the situation, the protest, and what your situations are now, and especially the hearings that are supposed to be held to determine what's going to happen with you.
So basically, CUNY broke their own bylaws in suspending us. They claimed a third protest that had sprung out the first week, they seized the center. On Thursday, October 24th, we had a rally in front of administration, and then we marched to the Knight building, home, where it was locked down again just because of the present. Right? All throughout this, it was, there's been, of course, a peaceful and legal protest. We tried to enter the building when security had locked it down. Although they were locking it down from protesters, but also from even non-protesters, people who were just going to go to class. This is during midterms week. They singled out, although a bunch of us came through the doors, it was maybe about 50 to 70 people. They singled out myself and Tafadar, and we would just say because of our politics. Monday morning. That was Thursday. The next Monday morning, I go to class. Well, I go early to school. I print out a bunch of papers to flyer for the next rally. I go to class at 9:30. At 10:45, I step out of class. These two men in suits are waiting outside my class. They give me this letter, confiscate my identification card, and they tell me that I'm banned from campus, I'm suspended, and that I have to call the Vice President Reyna. And then if I return, I'll be suspended. I will be expelled and I will be arrested for trespassing and expelled. And since then, it was 2 weeks past. Last Friday, we had our hearing, myself and Tafadar. We were represented by our attorneys, Mark Yu and Ron McGuire. Ron McGuire, who historically has been the most progressive lawyer and for on the behalf of, revolutionary and progressive forces in CUNY. Struggling. He himself was an activist at one point. He fought in the 69 struggle and on the side of black and Latino people, and that he was a white man, so he's a very good ally.
Yeah, we should mention that Ron McGuire was there when they tried to take down the signs and rename the Morales Shakur Center. Ron was there when they discovered that in a smoke detector there was a surveillance device that the university had put in. So, my goodness. It's too bad he has to be back again, but you've got some good representation there. So where do things stand now? What's the next step in terms of yourself? And then I want to spend the remaining time looking at whether there will also be a response to the new proposed further restrictions of speech and expression on the campus. So what happens with Tafadar and yourself, Khalil?
So this is Tafadar. I guess I'll speak. So what happens next is that, like, even though Khalil and myself are being targeted for suspension, it's because, like, there is an overall process of militarization going on that allows them to escalate to this level of discipline. And we don't want it to be about us. We want it to be about, like, the goal of liberating CUNY for the people. So we're going to... our organization is going to continue to mobilize people both for our hearings and to build ties between the community and the student body in order to, like, have that link there that allows for radical social change to be made. So we're going to continue organizing. We're going to continue bringing people out, building relationships between different organizations and different, like, social forces, groups of people on campus and in the community around.
Tafadar, I also want to ask you one thing. You mentioned earlier that, and I believe it was yourself that referenced the privatization now of the campuses. There's, you know, it's been a working class school. That was the character of it since its inception. And you're indicating that you think all of this is really about really changing the student body and damping down on the expression other than that which maintains the status quo. And I have to say, when I look at, you know, again, the new $5 million gift by the former Secretary of State, Colin Powell, to City College. So he's giving $5 million to his alma mater, and he had given $2 million previously. Is that what's really going on here?
For Powell Center.
Yeah. Is that...
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what the Revolutionary Student Coordinating Committee has always been saying is going on. It's like what's going on is, like, you know, everything has to be profitable now, so they chop down on anything that isn't, like the Morales Shakur Center, the space that it's in. They're going to be bringing in General Dynamics and General Electric, which are, like, two of the biggest military contractors out there, which is like a slap in the face to us because they're and that's where we organize the anti-militarization campaign out of, and it's also, like, a space that is meant to resist things such as privatization. So we're going to keep on mobilizing. We have many allies, such as, like, all the student organizations and student governments in CUNY, and even the Professional Staff Congress stands with us.
So do you think this is going on all of the SUNY-CUNY campuses? Is this a phenomenon that is just made to look like it's about the Morales Shakur Center, but is really much, much broader in what's happening with our education?
Well, we need to understand it on both. This is Khalil. We need to both understand it on both levels of general and specific. Right, so this is actually a national, in general, right, this is a national issue. We must remember that student debt is the largest debt in the nation, second largest debt in the nation right now, on the one hand. On the other hand, 53% of college four-year graduates nationally are either unemployed or unemployed in industries they didn't go to school for. So on the one hand, people can't even get jobs for things they got in debt, on the other hand, for things they just got in debt for. You know, they got in debt to get a... to have the ability to find, you know, a, you know, quote-unquote middle-class job, or whatever that's perceived to be. Now, that is no longer the case. So, I think the broader issues, and it all has to tie back to, you know, of course, U.S. imperialism. They have money for, you know, the military, the largest military budget in the world, to sustain, you know, the U.S.'s global empire. But they have to, you know, reject, they have to, you know, cannibalize other places like, you know, health and education. Basically, because we were organizing the most militant struggle out of the Morales Shakur Center, right, and it served the people, right? Out of the Morales Shakur Center, we have healthy farm shares, we had Know Your Rights trainings, we had anti-stop and frisk, you know, workshops, workshops for against violence against women, and these kinds of things, right? And this is largely why he even came to City College. And that includes Tafadar as well.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.